So much. Hope you guys are having a good time at Tech Ed. It's been really great talking with folks down in the partner pavilion between sessions, after sessions, after the keynote. It's been crazy. And one of the bits of feedback I keep hearing over and over again, and I heard this back at Tech Ed in New Orleans as well, which is, I cannot believe how much you guys have accomplished in Windows Server 2012 R2 and System Center 2012 R2. Just a lot of just shock, and it's pleasant to be able to do this. It's a real pleasure. My name is Jeff Woolsey. I'm a principal program manager in the Windows Server and Cloud division. I've had the pleasure of working on virtualization now for over 15 years. Way back when, I worked for a very small company called Connectix. Back then, people wanted to run Windows 3.1 and DOS on their Apple Power Mac 6100, 7100, and 8100. Not only was it virtualization, but it was binary translation going from x86 to PowerPC, which actually is far more difficult in many ways. And then as part of many years later, moved to Microsoft. I've been working at Microsoft now for over 10 years. Honestly, I love what I do. It's a tremendous pleasure and an honor to work in the server and cloud division. We are doing some awesome things right now, and we've got a lot to get to, so I'm going to get right into it. First of all, a huge thank you. I cannot say this enough. It's incredible the stories I'm hearing every day with people deploying Windows Server 2012, System Center, taking advantage of all the new capabilities. Replica is a perfect example of one of those things. It has been warmly received in the industry. But I just want to be very clear, and I want to thank you, because the reasons why you're seeing a bunch of these new capabilities is your feedback. Okay? The reason why Replica went into Server 2012 was to solve a very big problem out there, which was you folks want to be able to protect your business better. Disaster recovery technologies have been around for decades. Turns out no one's been deploying them or deploying them in very small scale because it's too complex, it's too difficult, and it costs way too much. So we wanted to go after that big problem. And now we're back again with things like Hyper-V Recovery Manager based on your input and feedback. So I just want to say thank you, and please keep the feedback coming. It's one of the reasons I enjoy coming to Tech Ed so much is the conversations. Understand, what are your pain points? Obviously, I love to hear when things are going great, but honestly, I want to hear when things are not going great, because that's going to help influence and make sure we're making the right decisions for the next release. Because you better believe we're already thinking about the next one. We're already planning that one. Okay, we're well underway on that one. This is a very agile Microsoft you're looking at right now. So one of the things I wanted to do is I want to start off with the Cloud OS vision. And my goal for this week is, by the end of this week, I hope you're sick and tired of this slide. I hope you've seen it so many times in so many different ways presented by so many people. You're going, oh my gosh, I'm so sick of Microsoft talking about the three clouds and their vision. Because if that's what you go home, it means you understand it. Because honestly, for the last year, I don't know how many people I've talked to that said, I don't get what Microsoft's cloud story is. And I'm like, really? You don't? Then let me be extremely transparent about what we're doing. This is not a secret. Let me be very clear about what our Cloud OS vision is. Let's explain it. So our Cloud OS vision, number one, when we think about cloud, it's really thinking about three legs to a stool. All right? And it starts in the private cloud. Let me give you a little history behind this, because I've literally watched this in the industry. Okay? Back in the 90s and the early part of the 2000s, everyone was buying servers. I worked at a small startup. Guess what? We were buying servers as well. We were probably at a point where we had a server for everybody in the company. Okay? Guess what? Servers were inexpensive. We all knew how to set them up. And guess what? People were buying servers left and right. In fact, even into the early parts, as I moved to Microsoft, I talked to customers that say, Jeff, I can buy as many servers as I need. I can easily, the budget's there. I can easily justify it. But the problem is I have no power to power them with and no place to put them. I'm in a Chicago high-rise. I'm in a financial building. For me to get more power, I need to go to the city and request an upgrade on the grid. Okay? These are the types of problems we were running into. So virtualization came up as a way to solve this problem. And you would basically say, look, I'm going to take 10 physical machines, 5 or 10 of these, I'm going to put them, virtualize them, put them on a single server, and I'm going to run them. That is virtualization for consolidation. That is great. There is nothing wrong with that, but that is not cloud. I get so many people that think, oh, I'm running cloud. No, no. That's virtualization for consolidation, and there's nothing wrong with it. You want to do that? We can do it right now, ready to go. But it is not cloud. You see, what happens is when you took those 10 and you virtualized them, you still managed them the same way. The management paradigm never changed. You still log into VM1, you still log into VM2, you change some memory, you change some networking, you change some storage, but you manage these as individual entities. That was great 20 years ago. That doesn't scale in cloud world. Just can't do it. You will not be able to hire enough people if you have to have individual people logging into servers, and it doesn't work in virtual machines either. With cloud, I want to be able to deploy services, not server. Services. I want to be able to say, look, I want to deploy a SharePoint service. Okay? That's a back end, middle tier, front end. Guess what? That's deployed as a unit. I want to say, by the way, it starts off with this amount of processors, this amount of memory, this amount of storage. But guess what? If it needs more, it grows automatically. I don't go in there and actually log into a VM and say, give me more storage, give me more networking. No. You define a policy for the service and you let the service grow. That is what cloud is all about. Cloud is requestable. Cloud is chargeable. Cloud is elastic. Cloud is highly available. Cloud is usage-based. And cloud is about driving down your costs. If you want to create a VM and say, this VM has 4 gigs of memory, it's running SQL, and it's got this type of storage, and this next VM is going to have 6 gigs of memory, and this next VM is going to have 8 gigs of memory, and you want to keep doing that little everything is a one-off, doesn't scale. That's not what cloud is about. Cloud is about highly standardized, highly templatized. I want to deliver you a small size SharePoint implementation, a medium size SharePoint implementation, a large size. We call these t-shirt sizes. It's all about standardization. Private cloud, when I say private cloud at Microsoft, it is Windows Server and System Center. Let me be very clear. I get all sorts of folks come up to me and say, hey Jeff, I'm running Hyper-V, I have cloud, right? Well, you got the makings for it. You got the infrastructure potentially for it. But you got to have systems management. You don't have cloud without it. Okay? Real clearly. Biggest mistake I see every customer makes, I chat with customers all the time. They come in and I say, you tell me you're running all of these workloads. Oh, everything's virtualized. Everything's great. And everything's wonderful. Great. So how are you managing it all? You know, I ask them very simple questions. How many VMs do you have? And that's just a very innocuous question. And very often the CTO will say, oh, we got about 10,000 VMs. Guy sitting next to him says, actually, it's more like 12,000 VMs. And the guy sitting at the end of the hall who actually is at the end of the table who's actually running it says, actually, it's closer to 20,000. They can't even tell me how many VMs they have. So how can you tell me that you're running services that are running healthy? Because at the end of the day, I don't care if I'm running SQL on physical, or if I'm running SQL on virtual, or if I'm running SQL on the cloud. I care that SQL's running well. That's what's important. So private cloud is about control. Okay? I've talked to plenty of customers around the world, and folks this week already that say, Jeff, I'm a company based in Germany. I have workload, I have data that has to live in a German data center on German soil run by a German citizen. Azure looks great, Azure looks phenomenal, Azure looks fantastic, but I have to control it. Great, that's what private cloud is about. You build Windows Server, you build Windows System Center, you build a cloud, guess what? This is not a technical conversation. Everyone seems to always get wrapped up and immediately go, well, I can't do it on Microsoft. No, not at all. You absolutely can do it on Microsoft. That's absolutely the plan. You should be able to do it wherever it makes business sense for you. That's a core principle of our cloud OS storage. So private cloud is about control. Public cloud, Azure. Public cloud is about scale. I can write an application, deploy it on Azure, and tomorrow say, by the way, I want this thing to run everywhere, like around the world, everywhere. I don't have to buy any compute, I don't have to buy any storage, I don't have to buy any network, and it's all usage-based. If you're a developer, this is like manna from heaven from you. You don't have to invest in any infrastructure. Let me give you a perfect example. Perhaps you've heard, there's this woman named J.K. Rowling. She wrote a few books about some wizard named Harry. My daughter reads them all the time, Harry Potter. And she was extremely successful. She has a huge fan base, literally around the world. So as a huge thank you, she wanted to develop an interactive site called Pottermore. Pottermore has videos, images, interviews, things that weren't in the book, things weren't in the movies. I mean, I think it's awesome. My daughter found out about Pottermore, lost her mind. She's like, Daddy, we're going right there. Loves it. They send her updates. They're always putting new things up there. Well, they actually started with Pottermore on a private cloud. They bought a whole bunch of servers, a whole bunch of storage, a whole bunch of networking, and then they announced the beta and turned it on. And like literally half the planet went there. They bought a whole bunch of hardware they couldn't even keep up. Within 2 weeks and a billion hits later, they had to stop accepting new people. And they had a big problem. Well, we can go buy a whole bunch of new hardware, a whole bunch of new storage, a whole bunch of new networking, but how do you do capacity planning when you're talking about, you know, Harry Potter fans around the world? They did one of these, and they said, we think we got it, and they weren't even close. So we said, you know, you could go buy some more hardware, but you know what? Why don't you just move this up to Azure? Guess what? That's exactly what they did. And next time when they turned it on, they said, okay, everybody, it's available. Guess what Azure did? Azure just went, boop, 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 boop. Oh, you need more? Boop, 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 boop. Just automatically grows. You need more? Boop, 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 boop. Just like that. It's all there. More storage, more compute, more networking. All done. Needs more, just gets it. And by the way, when there's fewer people, it shrinks. It's usage-based. That's what cloud is all about. That is scale. That's what you get from Azure. And the reason why this is important is because if you talk to, for example, if you talk to AWS, AWS will say, no, cloud is running virtual machines up here. Okay? If you talk to Salesforce.com, they'll say that SaaS is actually running up here. If you talk to VMware, they'll tell you, oh, no, it's private cloud running on premises. And I know they got some hybrid thing, but nobody still understands what it is. We believe it's all of these things. And finally, they're service providers. You see, private cloud is about control. Azure is about scale. Service providers is about reach and customization. Talk to folks all over the world. Folks and say, look, Jeff, I'm out in the middle of Australia. I was actually in Australia last year. And in the central northern part of Australia, they're doing a tremendous amount of mining right now. There's literally nothing out there. But guys are leaving college. They're paying them crazy amounts of money to go live in the middle of nowhere. There's precious minerals, natural resources out in the middle of nowhere. Well, there's a service provider out there giving them connectivity to the internet, phones. It's satellite phones. There's no cell phone coverage out there. It's literally the bush. We know there are places like this all over the world. Service providers can provide that reach, as well as customization. There are folks that have great relationship with service providers and say, look, you know what, I want to run my workloads in a specific rack lock that only you and I have the key to. We're not going to be able to do that in Azure. We can't scale to that. Service providers give you all of that. So the important thing to understand is when we talk about the cloud at Microsoft, it's all of these. Oh, and by the way, it's one consistent platform. You notice when I just brought up the Azure Pack. So the Azure Pack is all about providing this consistent platform. Think about this for a second. How many of you are building your own private cloud? Yeah? Wouldn't you love it if you had this nice, super clean UI that looked just like Azure? That's exactly what we're giving you. That's what the Azure Pack is. When you go to Azure, it's just awesome. It's so clean. It's crystal clear. But when you go to AWS or Salesforce or your own private cloud, you have a different interface every time. So your consumers have to learn something new. If your internal organization wants to go and ask for a SharePoint service, they've got to go to a specific portal. Maybe you wrote the portal. Maybe you bought a portal from someone else. We're basically saying, no, we're going to give you this code, the Azure Pack, and guess what? Now, use this in your own private cloud. Service providers, we want to give this to you as well. I spoke to a couple service providers yesterday. They said, I just called back to my service providers because I had a couple of designers actually trying to build this right now. I said, no, we're going to just use this. This is awesome. It's right there. And more importantly, it provides customers consistency. They don't want to have to go to one portal here, one portal there, and it's different every time. If I can go to my private cloud on-premise that you control, that you build, that you manage, and by the way, it's got that awesome professional Azure Pack UI. And by the way, it's consistent. If I decide I want to go up to Azure proper or to a service provider, that's tremendous. Everybody wins. So when we think about cloud, it's about making sure you have the best development tools. Visual Studio allows me to build my apps wherever they reside. On-premises, service provider, private cloud. Management. System Center is holistic to all of this. System Center here, System Center here, System Center in the cloud, Windows Intune, Windows Advisor, all of that work, all of the investment you make in System Center, that is a smart, strategic investment because we are only betting even more in System Center. One out of every two servers now is licensed for System Center. That's how popular it is. It is growing like wildfire right now because people have finally realized that private cloud is not a private cloud without systems management. System Center is exactly what we're doing for there. Data, big data. SQL Server here, SQL Server here. We also have SQL Server available as Azure Virtual Machines, and we also have SQL Servers available as a native Azure service. So however you'd like it, it's all there. Big data, Hekaton, oh my gosh. Hekaton rocks, okay? More investments in big data. Identity, Brad mentioned this in the keynote. Active Directory, it is the authoritative identity source. Using AD on your premises, service providers use it. And Azure, we have Azure Active Directory. And Brad mentioned this yesterday, we have almost 500,000 companies are federated already with Azure Active Directory, and it is growing like mad. Virtualization. Notice virtualization I have down here. It's a key important ingredient, but it's not the end-all be-all. And that's what the other guys have been selling for the longest time. Oh no, virtualization is the end state. No, it's not. Reducing costs is end state. Providing me elasticity, chargeability, usage-based, request-based, highly available, and continuing to reduce my costs, making it easier, giving me agility, that's the end state. Virtualization is certainly a key part of it. And by the way, that's Hyper-V, and that's Hyper-V. And yes, I am pointing at Azure. Azure is running hundreds of thousands of servers, and what is powering Azure? Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V. Full stop. That's the same bits you get. That is not a custom build. That is Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V. We are running the largest clouds on the planet with Hyper-V. No more asking me, is this thing enterprise ready? We're running one of the largest clouds on Earth with it and have been doing this for many years now. Hyper-V rocks. And that's what I can't wait to tell you about what we delivered in 2012. And an R2. So I'm going to quickly go through what we delivered in 2012 because we delivered a ton. Let's start with scale for just a moment. Right off the bat, you're looking at the largest scale numbers in the industry. You're looking at support for up to 320 logical processors per server. That's a 16-socket server. Each socket has 10 cores, and you enable symmetric multi-threading. Largest out there. We support up to 4 terabytes of memory per physical server. That's the largest physical machine you can buy today, twice as much as the other guys. 64 virtual processors per VM. Let me be very clear. 64 virtual processors in Windows Server 2012 Standard and Data Center Edition. To get that from the other guys, you got to go buy vSphere Enterprise Super Special Plus Edition at $5,000 per proc. This is in Windows Server 2012 Standard, it's in Windows Server 2012 Data Center, and spoiler alert, it's in my free hypervisor too. You see, we have a fundamental philosophy difference. The other guys sell you virtualization and nickel and dime you for every feature. We've heard loud and clearly from customers, they hate that. We don't think that way at all. My point is, I want to give you the best cloud infrastructure. I give it to you all. I don't do this a la carte stuff. Look at this one, 64 terabytes per virtual disk. That's over 32 times anyone else in the industry. That is not per VM, that is per disk. And we support 255 disks per VM. So I've done the math. It's roughly 16 petabytes per VM. So you're going to run out of physical storage long before you run out of virtual storage. And then we support 64 nodes and 8,000 VMs in a cluster. We did this for enterprises and service providers. And I know literally the day after we went RTM on 2012, we had a handful of service providers deploying 64-node 8,000 VM clusters. They were just waiting for the bits. Excited out of their mind. And this is actually really important because folks at service provider and enterprise, they want to basically build a large scale out cluster. Everything's highly available. And then I just want to pool all of those resources and put as many of those workloads as I can on there. And both numbers are really important. I get asked all the time, Jeff, do I have to have 64 nodes to do 8,000 VMs? The answer is no. Technically, we support 1,024 VMs per host. But I would never tell anyone, hey, let's go create an 8-node cluster with 8,000 VMs. That fault domain is just way too high, okay? So we support 64 nodes, and at 64 nodes, that's 125 VMs per server. But of course, if you want to go lower, you can. To give you an example, back at MMS just a few months ago, we were running all the hands-on labs. we had a 32-node cluster running over 8,300 VMs. Ran flawlessly. So it's there. Biggest clusters in the industry. When it comes to performance and scale, we've done a whole bunch of testing. This is done by a third party. This is SQL Server 2012 running inside of a Windows Server 2012 VM. And what you can see here is, due to the work that we've done inside of the virtual machine with what we call guest NUMA, non-uniform memory access within the VM, as you add more virtual procs, you're seeing nearly perfectly linear scalability within the VM. Let's be very clear here. The best way to run SQL, the best way to run Exchange, the best way to run Dynamics, Link, and SharePoint is on the Microsoft Hyper-V managed by Microsoft System Center. We test the heck out of this. We optimize, we tune, and then we optimize and tune some more, and then we optimize and tune again, and then we optimize and tune some more. All of this on Hyper-V. And did I mention Azure runs entirely on Hyper-V? So all of those learnings that we have there, we feed back into Windows Server. We then create new features and capabilities that we feed back into Azure. Oh, and by the way, Azure is also learning a whole bunch of telemetry, which they're making changes and feeding back into Windows Server. We call this the virtuous cycle, where Windows Server and Azure now are continuously feeding into each other, which means all of the cloud learnings we're getting running the largest global clouds out there, we're feeding right back into Windows Server that you just get. So everybody wins. So in Server 2012, demonstrated this last year at Tech Ed Europe, over a million IOPS. These were 4K IOPS. And it's not that with Server 2008 R2 was a slouch. We delivered over a quarter of a million 4K IOPS. But in 2012, we did over a million plus 4K IOPS. And if you saw me do the keynote the other day, you saw me crush this number even further. In 2012 R2, not only did we do 1.6 million IOPS, but we actually did 8K IOPS, which is actually what's used by SQL and Exchange and far more difficult. So not only did we get a 60% performance improvement, but we actually doubled the amount of data we were transmitting. Crazy performance. Not that 2012 was already leading the industry. 2012 R2, we just notched it up even higher. So dynamic high-performance storage. We made huge investments. And again, this is all still 2012. Okay? In 2012, live storage migration. Up to 64 terabytes per disk. The new VHDX format is awesome. I highly recommend that you stick with our defaults, which is by default, when you create a VM in 2012, we use VHDX because it does awesome things. Number one, it auto-aligns with your SAN. So if you've ever had any sort of alignment issues between the VHD and the actual underlying SAN, those are all gone in VHDX. We will automatically align best performance out of the box. Virtual fiber channel. We introduced virtual fiber channel in 2012. Folks are loving it because they need native access to their SANs, native access to their fiber channel fabric, and we present a real fiber channel, a virtual fiber channel HBA in the VM. We did this right. Okay, ours actually appears as a virtual fiber channel HBA, which means guest clustering works. It means multipath IO works. It means DSM software like EMC PowerPath just works. Other guys, nah. Doesn't work because they don't actually present an HBA in there. They do some funky weirdness in there. No, we did the right way, virtual fiber channel HBA. We also do offloaded data transfer, automatic trim and unmap. Automatic trim and unmap, I got to stop for 1 second. This thing is awesome. I was in a room full of storage architects a few months back and mentioned this, and one of the storage architects stood up and said, you got to be telling everybody about this feature because this is gold. So let me explain what this is. Today, if you've got a virtual machine and it's running, and say the VM is using 60 gigabytes of storage, and it's running on your SAN. Your super expensive, you know, gigabyte of storage costs me crazy amount of money on my SAN. All right? I've got a 60 gigabyte VM, and I go delete a 20 gigabyte file out of the VM. What happens to your SAN? Nothing. It doesn't see the delete. So even though you had a 60 gigabyte file, and you just deleted a 20 gigabyte file inside it, it doesn't tell the underlying storage. So the storage still sees, no, that's a 60 gigabyte file. In Server 2012, when you delete that file, we actually notify the file system. The file system notifies the underlying SAN. The SAN goes, oh, you just freed up 20 gigs of space. Let me go reclaim that automatically for you. There is no other hypervisor that provides automatic trim and unmap. None, even those owned by a storage company. This is automatically included in Windows Server 2012. People love this because now we can reclaim that SAN storage automatically. You don't need to script anything. You don't need to run anything. This is integration between the file system and your SAN. That's automatic trim and unmap. And then, of course, support for virtual machines and the new scale-out file server. The new scale-out file server is awesome, and I got to take a moment to talk about that. First, let me, before I do that, let me actually introduce Amit from NetBackup, because one of the things I wanted to quickly mention was some of the partner momentum we're seeing with Server 2012. One of those areas is backup for virtual machines. Hey, Amit, thank you very much for being here.
Nice to be here.
So let's go ahead and switch on over here. One of the things that has been announced, in fact, I believe it's just this last week or so, is NetBackup support for Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V. And not only does it include backup support, but there's a really awesome integration we want to show you off for the very first time here. One of the things I wanted to do is just kind of quickly walk you through the process of backing up Hyper-V through NetBackup and just show you that integration that they've already done in NetBackup that's available today, and then show you what that integration looks like through System Center. So right here, for example, we're going to create a new policy through NetBackup. And so we're just going to give this a cool name like TechEd. And you can see right here, you can create a backup policy. And the second option here is for the other guys and Hyper-V for virtual machine backup. We'll click on Next. And now you get to give it a name. And now we're going to go find the name of that Hyper-V server. So Amit's going to hear. He's going to go find the Hyper-V server that we want to go back up. And once we do that, now we can actually query the server to determine what are the VMs on it. And we can enable file recovery from VM backup, so it gives you granular recovery there. Let's go ahead and click on Next. And now we're going to select the virtual machines. So here, he's querying the Hyper-V server. We're going to and we actually get the listing of the virtual machines available. And yeah, let's go ahead and choose a couple here. Click OK. And just like that, okay, there we go. And so now we're going to click the
all drives
here. And now you can determine the policy for full backups. Do you want to do that? By default, yes. Do you want this to perform incrementals? You can do this, again, as part of the policy. You can determine the frequency of the backups, weeks, days, et cetera, the retention policies that you want to create. So all of this, again, configuring it in very granular. You can see it's even configurable all the way back to, you know, if you want to retain it for a year. Perhaps you've got legal reasons. You need to do something very specific. Maybe it's 2 or 4 years. You could create that as well as part of the policy. All right, we'll move right on here. You can see here, you can actually select when you want the backup to begin. Maybe you don't want this to actually be running throughout the middle of the day. You want this to be running at night or on weekends. You can determine when those scheduled hours are. It's got working hours in there. That's nice that you can schedule those. And just like that, you've configured the policy for net backup for Hyper-V. So very granular. If you're a net backup customer, you're already using it, this should look very familiar to you. Makes it very easy for those guys. You don't have to learn something dramatically new and different. Now, on top of that, this integration with net backup, they're also integrating with System Center Virtual Machine Manager. And as I mentioned before, Virtual Machine Manager and System Center is key to cloud. One of the things you want to be able to do, obviously, is you want to manage your compute, your networking, and storage. And check this out. NetBackup is actually integrated into VMM. They've got a plugin available right here. You can see at the very top here. And what you can see here is now I've got a quick glance and go view. I can see my whole backup estate. I can see the virtual machines. I can see, hey, I've got a total of 47. Hey, 10 of them have failed. So we can now go into the virtual machines, and we can do a sort here. You can see I can view and filter by which ones have failed. So now I can go in and take a look and figure out, hey, what was going on here? Do I have a storage issue? Do I have enough space? Am I having, what are the issues I need to resolve here? I can search by hosts. I can search by clusters. I can, lots of filtering, lots of capabilities here in terms of helping me find my backup and be most productive. What's also really cool here, though, is the integration itself with the launch recovery. So if I actually want to go recover a VM, clicking on here takes me right here into the Symantec Net Backup Virtual Machine Recovery, and now I can go select the source. And look how easy this is. Again, that integration, I don't need to context switch out, but when I do need to make that switch to get to my Net Backup, it's merely a couple clicks away. So here now, I can take a look at my backup type. So maybe I want to go and actually find the last one, or maybe I need to go find that backup from, oh, I don't know, a month or two ago. And I can actually go find, click on the date, and now get very granular. So you know what? Someone lost the file that they were working on from 3 weeks ago. I can go back to 3 weeks ago and get that file from that specific. So very easy, very intuitive, and that nice integration with System Center Virtual Machine Manager. So with that, I'd just like to thank Amit and the folks from Symantec. If you have any questions, we'll be here afterwards, and we can answer any more questions that you have about NetBackup. Thank you very much, Amit.
Thank you, Jeff.
So the ecosystem has been growing. We're very excited about the Symantec NetBackup support, and there's plenty more coming as well, and I'll be talking about that as I go through this. And again, that's available right now. And of course, we're working on them already on for R2. So, talking about storage, one of the things I like to be very clear about is I did the demo for Spaces the other day. I've been talking about automated storage tiering. And over the last year, one thing that became very clear to me as I was talking to about Windows Server 2012 was there are a lot of people that didn't understand what we were doing when it comes to the scale-out file server, when it comes to Spaces, how all of these things kind of plug into each other. There was a little bit of confusion. So I've been trying to very clearly articulate what Spaces is, what file server is, understand the relationship. And one of the ways, the easy way to do it, is to kind of start off with storage appliances as they exist today. So, for example, how many of you own a NAS device or a SAN device or anything like that? Lots of people raising their hands. Okay, great. So this may or may not sound familiar to you. So a lot of times you have one of those very expensive storage appliances that's sitting over in the corner, lots of blinky lights. No one even wants to look at it funny because, you know, you want to make sure that the thing just keeps humming right along. But what's interesting about a modern storage appliance is, have you ever actually looked inside or really understand what's going on in a storage appliance? Essentially, there's two parts. There's the actual disks themselves, and there's the storage head. And the storage head is what contains all of the smarts for the storage appliance. And if you actually open up that storage head, what will you find? Well, you'll actually find a whole bunch of x86, x64 processors. Usually there's two of them in there. On top of that, you'll find a whole bunch of memory, you'll find a whole bunch of network adapters, and you'll find storage HBAs. Those will be SAS controllers, most likely. And those are what's plugging into your disks. They call them shelves or expanders, usually. They give them some other name. Well, does this sound familiar? Because it sounds like a server to me, with a very different price tag on it, though. So let's take a look even further. If you take that storage head, and you kind of logically divide it in half into a front half, into a back half, what does the back half do? Well, the back half is what has those physical SAS connectors. Okay, this allows you to pool all of those disks, create mirrors, RAID sets, all of those things, gives you mirror parity, etc. And that, again, that's what plugs into your disks, and it's going to be over SAS. Then the front is actually presenting interfaces for your servers and your servers to attach to. iSCSI, fiber channel over Ethernet, NFS, or SMB. Now, of course, they never sell you one. They always sell you at least two. So this is what we call a scale-out storage appliance. And the reason why they sell you two is because if this one goes down, like literally someone pulls out the power plug on the back, then this one continues right along. This is an active cluster, okay? And usually they sell them in two, and sometimes I see people go as high as four, and usually some of these can go as high as eight, but usually most people stick within the 2 to 4 range because that's plenty of horsepower for most people. And so then your servers attach to these either via Ethernet, gigabit, 10 gigabit, or fiber channel to 1, 2, 4, 8, or 16 gigabit fiber channel. So that's kind of what a NAS or a SAN, that's kind of what it does. I feel like I'm, you know, letting everybody in on the magician's secret here, okay? But that's really what a storage appliance is. So what are we doing in 2012 and 2012 R2? All right. Now, does that look awfully familiar? The back part of that is Spaces. That's what Spaces is. You plug in all your SAS disks. Again, same disks, same interconnects, all SAS. You plug them in the back end, and Spaces then takes all of those and pools them. Create simple mirror, parity, mirroring, all of that. That's what Spaces is. And in fact, in R2, we're now adding automatic tiering. That's the storage tiering I demonstrated in the keynote. So now this could be not only hard disks, but I could throw in a couple of SSDs here. And when you throw in the SSDs here, that's when the magic begins. Because then we move the hot blocks to the SSD tier, and we leave the cold blocks on the hard disk tier. The hard disks give me capacity. The SSD gives me crazy IOPS performance. Then the front of this is the file server. And the file server is what presents my interfaces, iSCSI, NFS, SMB. Looks awfully familiar again, huh? And of course, we do two of these. Because guess what? It is a scale-out file server. Exactly the same you would with a scale-out storage appliance. In fact, ours is active-active as well. So if this one goes down, that's okay. The other one continues right along without any storage downtime. And in fact, not only do we support 2 or 4, we go all the way out to 8 nodes as well. So you get that as well. Finally, your servers attach to your storage, either over SMB3 Ethernet, gigabit, 10 gigabit, 40, or even 56 gigabit RDMA. You may be thinking, Jeff, 40, 56 gigabyte, that's a lot faster than Fibre Channel. Yes, it is. It is a lot faster than Fibre Channel. It's a lot less inexpensive than Fibre Channel as well. So one of the things we're doing here is we're making a huge investment in the file server, huge investment in spaces. Because one of the things that I've talked to customers around the world, and be very clear, spoiler alert, every customer has a storage problem. What did he just say? Yeah. Every customer I've talked to has a storage problem. It costs too much, I don't have enough, or I have it all over the place and it's managed and I can't manage them. I have all this siloed storage out there. We're trying to make this simpler. We're trying to make this easier. We're trying to drive down the costs, okay? That's what the file server and spaces is all about. So this is what that cloud deployment can look like. Here you can see I've got my Hyper-V servers. Those are my compute nodes communicating via SMB3 to my scale-out file server that's using spaces and my block storage. Scale-out file server, this is fault tolerant. Again, one server goes down, the other one continues right along. And again, this could be 2 nodes or all the way out to 8. 2 is great for most people. You can even go to 4 or 8, but it's there. And of course, the VMs are all highly available. We like this a lot. One of the reasons we like this is you can scale the compute and you can scale the storage independently. They're not locked to each other. So this is a great flexible deployment. So Jeff, deploying a Microsoft private cloud with the scale-out file server looks great. Can you show me what an ideal networking and storage configuration looks like? I've had this question a couple of times. So I thought we'd actually walk through that. So highly available at every layer. So let's start with the scale-out file server, file cluster. You've got that. You've got your 10 gig top of rack LAN RDMA. You've got your 210 gig NICs. On the left hand, it's going to be for networking. And on the right hand, 10 gig with RDMA for storage. You see, these two, we're going to team these. So we're going to take 210 gig NICs. We're going to team them together using the Windows Server teaming software. For storage, on the right hand side, we're going to use 10 gigabit with RDMA. But SMB has multi-channel transparent failover. So you're highly available from a storage perspective. And again, a key part of this architecture is it's highly available and resilient at every layer, every part of the stack. So let's go up. So now I've taken my networking. I've aggregated my 210 gigabit NICs. They're teams, so they're highly available. Now I'm going to carve them up. Okay, I'm going to use VLAN trunks. So I have VM LAN, so that's networking for the virtual machines. I have live migration network, I have a cluster shared volume network, I have an iSCSI network, and I have host management. Those are all the different networks I need. I just carve it up in software. Then I have Hyper-V parent partition, I've got Hyper-V, I've got virtual switches, and again, now I've got my different switches above, I've got a VM VLAN trunk, I've got a live migration, cluster CSV, and iSCSI, and now I've got my virtual machines at the top. Now you notice I've got two types of VMs. I've got a clustered VM and a non-clustered VM. And the reason why I have this is because I want to show you is that I'm just running a non-clustered VM, like a standalone print server or a standalone IIS server, and it's non-clustered, fine. Then that's how it's configured. But if I want to provide guest clustering, so for example, I have an application that I want to do guest clustering in, guess what? That's why I have iSCSI over here, because I can present an iSCSI LUN into the virtual machine to do guest clustering. Now, spoiler alert, in 2012 R2, we're making this even easier by introducing a new capability called Shared VHDX. So you can do guest clustering without even having to use iSCSI or having to present an iSCSI LUN into the virtual machine. And I'll show that in just a minute. So finally, VM mobility. We delivered top flight VM mobility in Server 2012. Not only do we give you live migration with clustering, live migration with the file server, shared nothing, live migration. The other thing we also did was concurrent live migration. Folks, this is 40 VMs live migrating simultaneously. Let me say that one more time. This is 40 VMs live migrating simultaneously. This is four times the other guys, but actually I can do a lot more. In case you're wondering, this is two 10 gigabit NICs. This is two 10 gigabit NICs team. That's all it is. And in fact, down here, I've got a PowerShell interface. The reason why I've got PowerShell, The reason why I have PowerShell is because I couldn't even go through the UI fast enough. The live migrations were happening so fast. Let me just make sure that's running. No, it's not. So we introduced this in 2012. Essentially, this is unlimited concurrent live migration. It's limited only by the hardware you want to bring to the party. So if you've got servers with 1 gigabit Ethernet, yeah, maybe I can live migrate one or two, maybe four. If I've got 10 gigabit, maybe I can live migrate 10 or even 20. If I've got dual team 10 gigabit, maybe I can live migrate, 40. If I've got quad team 10 gigabit, I've actually demonstrated over 200 virtual machines live migrating simultaneously. And again, this is all in Server 2012. I haven't even gotten to R2 yet. That's when it gets even just crazy. So this is what we're shipping right now is available today. And if you're not deploying Server 2012 right now, you shouldn't wait. So let's take those learnings now to R2. So that's all the stuff, everything I've shown you up to now is what we're shipping in 2012. Customers, we've seen customers deploying pretty much since day one. Now we want to tell you about the things that we're learning and taking to R2. So your feedback. You told us, and this is something that service providers especially told us, Jeff, data center licensing is great. We love the fact that you buy data center edition, you get unlimited copies of Windows Server. But activation can be a pain, especially for a service provider. Pixie boot, OS deployment. Today you have to do Pixie deployment, you have to use the emulated NIC. It means you have to have managed different NICs, you have to emulated versus synthetic. We love the storage enhancements. Keep doing more in storage. We heard you loud and clear. The other thing you told us is guest clustering is difficult. It's a real pain, and I'll explain that in just a minute. So let's talk about activation. So one of the things that's very interesting in a cloud service provider is every so often someone will say to me, well, Jeff, aren't enterprises and cloud service providers the same? Oh, no. No, they're actually very different. Quite different. Here's a good example. A service provider, notice this red line. This red line is super important. If I'm a cloud service provider, I am focused on everything below the red line. I provide compute, I provide storage, I provide networking, and I'm trying to drive down those costs as much as possible because that's my margin and that's how I make money. If I'm an enterprise, guess what? Most enterprises I realize fall into two categories. Enterprises that realize they want to be a cloud service provider and enterprises that haven't realized that they want to be a cloud service provider yet. Because I talk to plenty of CXOs that say, hey, I like that elasticity thing, I like the requestable, I like the chargeable, I like the highly available. I'm like, oh, you want to be a service provider. No, no, I don't want that. Actually, you do. So this bottom layer, the cloud service provider is super focused on. Above that line, I have tenants. Customers, I'm giving them VMs. They see a virtual machine, they see storage, but they don't know what type of storage is. They don't know what the NICs are in the machine. They just see virtualized resources. Well, there's actually a little problem, and it's our problem that we need to fix, which is what we're doing right now. Service providers activate their hosts with a KMS server on their network. However, customers aren't on that network. The tenants are actually on their own networks. So you get this problem where they can't activate. So we want to fix that problem. So in Server 2012 R2, we're introducing automatic VM activation. What this means is, if you're running Windows Server 2012 R2 Data Center Edition, and it's already activated, then we will automatically activate the guests for you. So this makes it super easy for a service provider. You simply deploy Server 2012 R2 Data Center. And the host is that. And if the guests are running Server 2012 R2 Standard, Data Center, or Essentials, we will automatically activate them. So it makes life a lot easier. And the way this works is we'll actually provide a key. There'll be a key. In fact, we'll post it publicly. We'll tell everybody, here's the key. Use this for Standard, Data Center, Essentials if you're running in a VM on Hyper-V. And what'll happen is it'll check to see if it's running on Hyper-V. And if it is, great, you're all done. Just makes life a lot easier. Hyper-V VMs. So interesting thing about VMs, if you look inside a Hyper-V VM today, and I mean literally go to Device Manager and take a look, what will you find? You'll find an Intel Pentium 440BX motherboard. You'll find a whole bunch of things that look like a PC from about 1997, 98. And in fact, that's true of VMware, that's true of Xen, that's true of KVM, it's true of all the virtualization vendors. So why do we do this? The reason we do this is for backwards compatibility. You say, hey, Jeff, I super really want to run DOS. No, really you don't, but okay. But I want to be able to run those older operating systems. So what we did was we all made our virtual machines look like some older piece of hardware out there that had a lot of well-known drivers for it. So guess what? It just works. If you want to run Windows NT on Hyper-V, guess what? It actually works. 2000, yeah, it works. You want to run those old musty, crusty things? Yeah, you can do that. However, they also carry some other interesting challenges. Like I said, Pixie Boat only works off the emulated NIC, which is slow. It has a traditional PCAT BIOS. I like to laugh that this is handcrafted 16-bit code, old-world craftsmanship. It's limited to 2.2 terabytes for the boot volume, and it boots from virtual IDE only. This VM has been highly optimized. Like I said, 64 virtual procs, a terabyte of memory, over a million IOPS. It's crazy performance. The problem is we want to do more. We actually want to advance the state of the art. We want to move virtualization beyond that. So we're going to introduce new Hyper-V VMs, Generation 2 virtual machines. All, just to be very clear, but before I get into this, everything you have today on Hyper-V just continues to work. Those are all Generation 1 VMs. But now we're introducing a new type of VM. Number one, these can boot off the synthetic NIC. In fact, these don't even have an emulated NIC in them anymore. The emulated NIC is gone on the Gen 2 VM. So you can boot off the high-speed synthetic NIC. Number two, when it comes to storage, and within the VM, we actually have a UEFI firmware now. We got rid of the whole PCAT BIOS. So now we can boot off virtual SCSI, and now we can support GPT partition disks greater than 2.2 terabytes. We can also now resize the virtual disk online. So you can hot add and change the size of the VM. You can grow it or shrink it online. And one other benefit, oh, I got a couple claps there. Glad to hear that. One other side little benefit is because we got rid of IDE, there is no IDE bus on this one. There is simply no IDE. Because we got rid of it, we had to move the DVD ROM to virtual SCSI. Now it means you can hot add and remove the DVD. So that's a little nice little benefit. One other nice thing about Gen 2 VMs is that we support secure boot. Because you've got UEFI firmware in there, we can help protect and take advantage of secure boot within the VM. Customers, as you start to think about cloud, a lot of folks want to make sure, is there anything that I can do to help protect my VMs as they move to service providers or off my premises? We're looking at this very carefully, and this is one way to do it. Now, one thing I'm going to be very clear about, oh, and actually this is what it looks like. When you create a Gen 2 VM, it's a one-time ask. You get asked up front, is this a Gen 1 or a Gen 2? By default, we will stick with Gen 1. Gen 1 will continue to be the default. But you're asked just to be a Gen 1 or Gen 2. Once you create it, you can't change it. And the reason why is because when you install an OS, it installs differently for PCAT BIOS versus UEFI firmware. It's actually laid down on the disk differently. So converting is not possible. Here are the VM settings. Notice on a Gen 1 VM, you got all sorts of things. You've got an IDE controller, you got COM ports, you got a floppy disk, all sorts of stuff. Gen 2 VMs, nope, you got procs, you got SCSI controllers, you got NICs. There's no emulated NIC here because it doesn't exist. There's no floppy disk because honestly, it's 2013. What are you doing with a floppy disk? Inside the VM, we got rid of PCI. There's no PCI bus in our virtual machine. Gen 1, what you have today, has a PCI bus. It has an ISA bridge. When's the last time you saw a machine with an ISA bridge in there, huh? Yeah, that's what our VMs have in them. All the VM vendors have these. COM ports, floppy controllers, processor to PCI bridge, IDE controller. Those are all gone. In Gen 2 VMs, it's all attached to the VM bus. This is our high-speed in-memory bus. This is all done here. And again, no floppy controller, no ISA bridge, none of that stuff. I don't need any of those things in a Gen 2 VM. We want to advance the state of the art. Now, one thing I want to be very... Oh, and here are some of the other enhancements. Here's the translation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, all this said, these are not for everyone. I'm going to stand up high. In fact, big red light, big sign here. These are not for everyone. I'm being super transparent about this. These are x64 VMs only. I don't care about x86 VMs. You want to run 32-bit? Great. Generation 1 VMs are still there. They'll be around a very, very long time. Don't expect those to go away. That's why they're still the default. If you need to run old OSs, stick with Gen 1 VMs. Again, that's why it's the default. This only supports Windows 8 and 2012 and later. We're working on Linux support, but as you can see, we've made some pretty big changes inside the VM, and we've got a lot of work to do to make Linux work. Your investment in Hyper-V is safe. Every VM you've ever created with Hyper-V just works. You don't need to convert. You don't need to do anything. Those are Gen 1 VMs, and in fact, Gen 1 and Gen 2 run great, all together on the same server. You don't need to do anything. Okay? It's just within the virtual machine, it looks different. So, one of the other... Oh, and by the way, I should point out that those were all the enhancements for Gen 1 and Gen 2 VMs. All the new enhancements I'm going to show you still apply to both Gen 1 and Gen 2. Okay? So, for example, enhanced VM interaction. So we now have remote desktop over VM bus. One of the nice things about this is you're going to get full remote desktop capabilities like shared clipboard. You want to copy and paste between the host and guest. It now works, but we had to be very careful when we did it. Other guys have done it. They've hacked it. It's not secure. We don't release insecure products at Microsoft. We focus very carefully on our trustworthy initiative, and we made sure that this is all done through RDP, and it's completely safe. So you can copy and paste files, desktops, everything in between that. Audio redirection. You want to double-click on a movie and watch a movie in a VM, and guess what? The audio comes out your speakers. So this is great, especially for client. On client Hyper-V, where people want to run things in a test dev environment, just gives you better fidelity there. Enhanced logon through smart card and things like that. And even when the network is down. So for example, it integrates with the remote desktop gateway. So if you need to access a virtual machine remotely now, and you've actually lost network access to it, because we integrate with the desktop gateway, you can still get a console session of the virtual machine even remotely. So very excited about all of these capabilities, and of course they all work with live migration. Now in terms of storage, what did you tell us? You said, Jeff, really want to be able to resize virtual storage. I need to manage storage to an SLA. Help us protect against the noisy neighbor. Guest clustering is a pain. We want to do it, we really, really want to do it, and it's just brutal. Dedupe is great for VM libraries, but we need more, especially for VDI. The VDI, almost every VDI implementation that gets stopped is due to storage. Cost, complexity, I/O performance, it's a real tough nut to crack. So we wanted to make sure we provide a whole bunch of enhancements there as well. So in terms of storage, I mentioned this before, but here it is, online virtual disk resize. You can both grow and shrink your SCSI VHDXs on the fly. And it doesn't matter what the guest OS is going to be. I've had a number of people ask me, will this work with Windows 7? Doesn't matter. It works with Linux. Okay? This all happens below. This is at block level. So you can do all of this on the fly. So let me get back to service providers and enterprises for a second. Got an interesting story for you. Noisy neighbors. So today, again, I'm running my cloud. My cloud has compute, storage, and networking. So I've got storage here, and this storage will give me 1,000 IOPS. Okay? That's what it's designed to do. It's going to give me 1,000 IOPS. And I've got 10 customers. Each one of these has their own VM. Everything is running fine. Everything is good. This is magical, mystical nirvana. Everyone is happy. Customer 1 fires up a SQL server consuming 950 IOPS. Customer 1 is thrilled. Cloud is awesome. Cloud rules. This is why I went to cloud. My cloud vendor rocks. Customers 2 through 10 are really, really angry right now. Their performance just fell off a cliff. Everything was running just fine. Now they're all sharing 50 IOPS. They're getting crushed. So their salespeople are now calling my cloud service provider saying, I want my money back. You're not meeting your SLA. My tech support guys are getting hammered, going, what's going on with my performance? And I'm the cloud service provider, and I'm losing money every moment that this is happening. So guess what the cloud service provider does? This is a real true story. They actually go, and they go kill that VM. They go find out that VM number one is consuming 950 ops, and they actually go turn it off. Yeah, this is what they're doing. So the cloud service provider needs to resolve this situation, and he literally goes and shuts it off. I have no idea if that was a real SQL Server process, or if it was some bad process, or if some malware, or something went awry, some process or thread went runaway and just started consuming IOPS, so I just go kill it. So now, my other customers are happy, they've got all their performance back, but now my customer number one is really upset and angry. So no one wins in this situation. We want to help solve this problem. The noisy neighbor problem is a very real problem. So in Server 2012 R2, we're introducing storage quads, where you can set hard maximum caps. So for example, in this last example, I could have said, you know what? Everybody gets 50 IOPS because you decided to go with bronze level support. But in fact, someone says, you know what? I would like to go up to silver level support. Great, maybe I may get 100 IOPS. But that is the absolute maximum. Even if I went off and fired off that SQL Server query and it thought it could use 950 IOPS, it only gets whatever I type in that maximum number. If that number is 25, that's all you get. It'll take longer. It'll work, but it'll just take longer. For the service provider, this is an opportunity. I can come back and say, you know what, I've noticed, wow, you seem to be using a lot of storage. Maybe we should move you up to the silver package where you can get 100 IOPS, or the gold package, you get 250 IOPS. Maybe we move you up to the platinum package, you get 500 IOPS. And as the customer, you're happy because you know what? At least you know you're getting your service level agreement met. But you're avoiding this whole noisy neighbor problem. Everybody wins in this. Brand new included in 2012 R2. And yes, it works with virtual ID, works with virtual SCSI, and it's available on a per virtual disk basis. So you can see this is a SCSI, this is a virtual disk under the SCSI controller, and it has this new advanced features here for quality of service management. And yes, it works for Gen 1 and Gen 2. So online resizing, storage quads, it's all there. Guest clustering. Again, I'm going to go back to the red line because the red line is really important. This is actually an issue in service providers and some enterprises. So infrastructure administrators. Again, the guys below the line, I'm focused on everything here. And I want to make sure that this red line means I can change out storage, I can change out networking, I can even, you know, upgrade you to new compute, and you never know about it. Because on top of the red line, you get VMs and you get virtual disks. You never actually see the physical hardware. Well, my customer says, look, I need HA. I need to be able to cluster my virtual machines, okay? The problem is this. Today, to do guest clustering means I have to create a hole. Because I have to present an iSCSI LUN or a fiber channel LUN up to those VMs so that those VMs have shared storage and they can do guest clustering. I'm the cloud service provider. You know what I say? Not happening. Not doing it. I do not give you access to the physical infrastructure. You do not break this barrier. Nobody does it. So guess what? Everybody's unhappy. Customer's unhappy because they want to deploy highly available service. Service provider's unhappy because they can't, and they want to be able to service their customer. This is a really, really hard problem. We want to solve this. That's why we're introducing shared VHDX virtual disks. With shared VHDX, guess what we're doing? We're creating a virtual disk that lives above the red line. It's a VHDX file. It's a virtual disk. It's a file. But guess what? It's now available for sharing by multiple VMs. Within the VMs, this appears as shared SaaS. So guess what? Guest clustering, all of your tools just work. Everybody's happy because now I can do guest clustering in the cloud. I may have been doing this on premises. Now I'm going to move it into the cloud, and guess what? It all just works. For my service provider, I am thrilled because now I can offer this as a service. And yeah, I'm going to charge you a little bit more. But you know what? You're used to paying more for HA. And plenty of folks will say, look, I'm happy to pay for it because I have to have HA. I'm not moving to the cloud without it. This solves a very difficult problem with shared VHDX. Very thrilled to be bringing this to Windows Server 2012 R2. I mentioned this, in fact, I showed this in the keynote. Deduplication with running VMs. I'll be very clear, this is focused on VDI. Had a couple people ask me, well, what about just general server like SQL or Exchange? No. First of all, good luck finding deduplicated storage in SQL and Exchange. That's why you don't want to do it. We're focused very much and testing very much on VDI because that's where you have common images. You have lots of potential for deduplication. So that's why we focus this release on VDI. You can expect over time, yeah, we'll probably broaden this out to other workloads. But for this release, we're going to be very specific. It's about reducing the cost for VDI. So I demonstrated this earlier this week. We did over 1 million last year. We did over 1.6 million this year. And to me, the bigger story is not only did we do 1.6 million, but this year, we did 8K IOPS. 8K IOPS is what SQL uses and Exchange uses. So I'm going to say it again. The best way to deploy SQL, the best way to deploy Exchange, Dynamics, Link, SharePoint, et cetera, is on Hyper-V. Because we test, and then when we're done, we test some more. And then we optimize, performance, tune, and rinse and repeat every build, every day. We're very focused on that, extremely excited, and we haven't, again, we're just releasing the preview bits now. We've still got some more tuning to do. All right, solving tough problems. So here's an interesting one. Imagine you're running an application, and it just goes dead. Like, I can't ping it anymore. It's like it's lost network connectivity. What do you do? This is a production workload. Unfortunately, your options are not good. Your options are, I can take the service down, and I can go pore through logs and take a look and see what the problem is. Of course, now all my customers are upset because there's downtime. Where's my app? What's going on? What are you guys doing? I have downtime. The other option is, I can just, you know what, we'll just restart it, or we'll restart the service, and hope that that was a transient problem and never comes back. Now, that doesn't fill me with a lot of confidence either. So what we really want to do is give you a third option. Option three is live export of a VM. So now, imagine this scenario. You have a problem with your app. You want to debug it. Guess what? You clone it. You create a live clone of that virtual machine. You give it to test dev. Test dev can now go pour through all the logs. It's the same exact thing. So they can pour through the logs and go, you know what? This was a transient problem. No problem. It'll be fine. Or they can realize, oh, you know what, we have a bug here we need to go fix. Let's test and release the patch here on this exact clone and redeploy back into production. Whoa. We've just made the life of test and dev a lot better. And we've helped you give you more confidence in what you're deploying in production. So this is really cool. Again, live export all in 2012 R2. So you've given us a lot of input about HA, mobility, replication. Jeff, Windows Server NIC teaming is great. Keep improving network performance. Absolutely. Make it easier to upgrade the cloud infrastructure. Gotcha. Hyper-V live migration is awesome. Push it even further. Hyper-V replica is awesome. Can we configure the replication frequency? So one of the other things in terms of HA is we're now adding HA to the network. So what happens is today, if you're running a cluster and you pull out the power cable, what happens? VMs will automatically restart on other cluster nodes. Well, what happens if you go out and you unplug the network cable in by accident? Well, nothing happens because the VMs and everything is still running. We just assume that, you know you're going to plug it back in. However, with protected network, we now are taking HA to the network. So what we're assuming is, hey, you know what? Somebody unplugged the cable, but if I look across the cluster, all of the other nodes in my cluster have network connectivity. So what I can now do is it will automatically live migrate those VMs to other nodes in the clusters that aren't experiencing this network downtime automatically for you. Really cool. Detects network cable failure, network adapter failure, and of course, all of it works with NIC teaming. Virtual RSS. So we've introduced RSS in the host. We've got virtual machine queues in the virtual machines, but we are also now adding virtual RSS into the virtual machine. What this allows us to do is to spread network traffic across multiple virtual processors in the VM. So what this means now is, even without using SRIOV, If you're using VMQ and virtual RSS, we can now push line rate. You want to get 9 gigabytes into a VM, we can do that now. If you need more, great. Go to SRIOV, and you can get up to 20 gigabits and still have live migration. With live migration, I demonstrated this in the keynote, compression. This is just awesome. In fact, it's the new default now. We will just default with compression enabled. It is that awesome. Pretty much, on average, we see at least a 2x performance improvement. At least. On VMs that have been sitting idle, not doing much, I've seen it as high as 5 to 6x performance improvement. It's crazy. All we're doing is using a little bit more CPU to compress the VM in line during live migration and give you more efficient, faster live migration. SMB Direct, this one is just mind-blowing. You saw this one in the keynote. This is now we're taking advantage of the work that we did in 2012 in the file server, bringing this to live migration. We are now talking remote DMA performance. SMB Direct is so fast, this live migration is so fast, the speed of your RAM now matters. If you're using 1066 RAM versus, you know, 1888 or the 2100, whatever those higher rates are, you will see a difference in performance. PCI Express now is a bottleneck for us. We see different live migration performance on PCIe 2 versus PCIe 3. That is how fast this is absolutely maxing out the system. We've never seen anything like this before. It is awesome. And we're going to continue to invest heavily in SMB Direct and RDMA. By the way, the guidance is if you're using 10 gigabit or less, use compression. If you're using more than 10 gigabit, go with SMB Direct. Zero downtime upgrade. This was something I really wanted to show in the keynote. We just didn't have enough time. But say you've deployed Server 2012 already today, and now you set up 2012 R2, guess what? You can now drag and drop with virtual machine and literally live migrate from 2012 to 2012 R2. You've just upgraded all of your VMs to the new cloud infrastructure. So we've made it really easy to deploy from an older Hyper-V cluster to a newer Hyper-V cluster. And yes, that includes shared nothing live migration. So now for the first time ever, cross-version live migration. We also have near-synchronous replication. One thing we heard many times from folks with Replica and Server 2012 Watch is, we love it, but we want a little bit more configuration. Turns out people are running Replica. In fact, at Microsoft, turns out our Microsoft campus now has gone crazy with Replica. People are replicating their labs all over campus, from Redmond to Seattle. They're using Replica, and we have some nice big pipes. So 5 minutes is actually too long. They want 30 seconds. So now we've got near-synchronous replication in the box with Replica. On the other hand, we've also spoken to folks all over the world that say, you know what, my network connectivity is really poor. I've got satellite coverage. It's really dodgy. It goes up and down. My latency's really bad. My throughput's really bad. I need a little bit more leeway in Replica. So now we've got 15 minutes as part of Replica as well. So 2012 Replica, honestly, customers said, we love it. Give us the configuration. But at the same time, we told our service providers, what a great opportunity for you. If you're a service provider, you should be a Replica target. Because guess what? Replica works with any storage. You don't need to set up a SAN. It works with a file server. It works with direct attached storage. It works with pretty much any storage out there. So customers, for service providers, this is great. However, we didn't realize we had one little problem we didn't realize. So customers want to replicate because maybe they don't have a secondary site, and a service provider makes all the sense in the world. So it's a great business opportunity. The problem was service providers said, yeah, this is great, but I have my own secondary site, and I want to use Replica. I don't want to have to go buy my own SAN storage to be able to do this, because I need a secondary backup site of my own. So in Server 2012 R2, we're now introducing tertiary replication, which means my customer can now replicate to a service provider, and the service provider can also take advantage of it and replicate to their secondary site. Or if you're an enterprise and you just want to do tertiary yourself within your own infrastructure, you can do that as well. So that's a real cool new capability built right into 2012 R2. So one thing I wanted to mention was Hyper-V server. Now, a lot of few people may or may not know, but we also have a completely free version of Hyper-V server. And let me say this one more time. It is a completely free version of Hyper-V server. No strings attached. I know the other guys will tell you there's all sorts of strings attached. It's completely free. You can download the ISO. What is it? Well, that's Hyper-V Server. It's a command line interface. But it is the full, rich, enterprise-class Hyper-V. All there. All the features you're looking for. Now, what's different is, number one, it's just the hypervisor. This isn't Windows Server. Server comes with domain controllers. It comes with print servers. It comes with all sorts of roles and things like that. This is just the hypervisor. Okay? It's designed for you to install it on the bare metal, join it to your domain, and then manage it remotely. You can use System Center Virtual Machine Manager, you can use System Center, or you can use our free remote administration tools. It does not require System Center. I know the other guys always try and make that point. That's completely false. And by the way, this is a feature-rich hypervisor. This is not a dumbed-down version. This is not a scaled-down version. I'll show you. But it's designed for remote management. So why would you use this? In fact, Microsoft, come on, why are you giving this away? Well, there's a bunch of great reasons why you'd want to use it. Number one, Linux. People say, look, I'm using Windows Server Data Center Edition because it gives me unlimited copies of Windows Server. But if I put Linux on there, it means one of those licensing slots is not being used for Windows, it's being used for Linux. So Microsoft, what are you going to do for me? Here's what I'm going to do for you. I'm going to give you a free hypervisor called Microsoft Hyper-V Server. Put all your Linux on it. And guess what? You can manage it all from System Center. So you can manage it from one big management console, and it manages everything. It's also great for VDI. If you're considering VDI, guess what? Windows Server is awesome, but Windows Server Data Center Edition provides server instances. It does not provide client instances. So in that case, you could actually use Microsoft Hyper-V Server just fine because it doesn't include any licenses. It's a free hypervisor, and put all your desktops on it. And it's great for a hoster virtualization platform. You just want to deploy this thing, manage it remotely at scale anyways. Hyper-V Server is a great way to do that. So, lots of common questions. Number one, Jeff, is this an eval version? Come on, is this going to time out? Is there activation? No, it's completely free. Enterprise class hypervisor for everyone. And trust me, the reason why I put these up here is because everybody, no one ever believes me. Is this supported in production? Yes, since day one. Does Hyper-V Server have reduced or limited scale? No, it's the full deal. Is System Center required for live migration or live storage migration? No. It's all in there. Okay, but Jeff, come on. Clustering is not included, right? No, actually, clustering's in there. Clustering's all in there. You get HA, and it has been since Hyper-V Server 2008 R2. Okay, but Jeff, it doesn't include live migration, right? Yes, it does. Does it include shared nothing live migration? Yes, it does. Okay, but it doesn't include the extensible switch, right? No, it includes that as well. Does it include replica? Actually, yes, it does. In fact, spoiler alert, what's the best way to replicate Linux? Answer, Hyper-V Server. I just gave you a free way to protect all of your Linux. You're welcome. So, I always get the question asked, Jeff, come on, can you compare it to the other guys? What's the comparison? Well, there really isn't one, okay? First of all, yeah, okay, theirs is free, but they're physical processors, okay? I honestly don't even know what it is. I can't find it. I've looked. Doesn't matter, though, because they limit the physical server to only 32 gigs of memory, which, honestly, in my opinion, makes this thing irrelevant right off the bat. It only supports up to 4 virtual processors per VM. We have none of these limitations. Does it have HA? Does it have vMotion? Does it have storage migration? Does it have storage virtualization? Does it have replication? No, 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 no. The answer is, we want to get you to try this. We're going to limit it super hard, and then we're going to sell you this for $5,000 per proc. That's what they do. I give you all this for free. It's all there. 64 virtual procs in a VM, up to 4 terabytes in a VM, up to a terabyte of memory per VM, live migration, live storage migration, shared nothing live migration, the extensible switch, Hyper-V replica, it's all there. All in Hyper-V Server 2012. So, Jeff, why are you doing this? What's going on? You're not doing this continuing, right? Well, again, there's your limits. Pretty much, ours are all there, theirs are all none. And I'd like to announce Hyper-V Server 2012 R2. So yes, Everything I've been showing you in Windows Server 2012 R2, all the live migration compression, all the live migration with RDMA, guess what? I'm giving that to you as well. It's all here. Gen 2 VMs, networking, virtual RSS, online disk resize, storage QoS, shared VHDX, spaces, storage tiering, live export, live migration, Hyper-V replica. Please, 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 there is no comparison. It's just, there isn't. It's not even close anymore. Okay? They haven't caught up to 2012, and we're now racing ahead in R2. And guess what? This is all free. So we are very clear. We want to make sure we give you the best infrastructure for cloud. This all goes back to our three clouds. We want to make sure, whether you're doing it on-premises with a service provider or in the public cloud, that we give you the best way to do all of that and achieve all of that. Last thing before I close out here. I get this question asked all the time. Jeff, I'm getting ready to purchase some new storage, getting ready to purchase some new hardware. What should I look for? Great question. Here are the things you should be looking for. If you're looking at file-based storage, SMB3. This is an absolute must. They say, oh no, we support SMB1 and SMB2. The answer is, thank you very much, but I'm not interested. It's SMB3 or nothing. SMB3 is light years ahead of SMB1 and 2. Honestly, I'm embarrassed that people are still shipping SMB 1.0 products. They should be ashamed of themselves. That protocol was defunct 10 years ago. That's how bad it is. SMB2 got better. SMB3, just without peers. You get SMB compression, you get SMB encryption, you get multi-channel support. It scales, it's unbelievable. It's fantastic. Make sure you ask for SMB3. Otherwise, that's what you're looking at when you're looking at SMB 1 and 2. SMB Direct RDMA, something you definitely want to consider because it gives us dramatic performance improvements without additional CPU utilization. If you're looking and considering file server with spaces, ask your storage partners, do you have spaces certified JBODs? Because I just want to be able to plug in and add more disk trays to my file server. And you can find these on the Windows Server catalog. But please, ask your storage vendors and say, I really would like these. Trust me, they will listen to you. SAN array features to look for. If you're still very much invested in SANs, great. Hyper-V, Hyper-V 2012 R2 works great with SANs. There's nothing wrong with that. Guess what? Make sure it supports offloaded data transfer. Question one, does this support ODX? If the answer is no, then the answer is great. I don't want to see any more storage. Show me the ODX storage. With ODX, we take advantage of capabilities built into the SAN, and we will drastically improve performance by taking advantage of offload capabilities in your SAN. Huge performance improvements. NPIV. If you're going with fiber channel, if you want to use virtual fiber channel, obviously, make sure your virtual fiber channel adapters support NPIV. This has been around for a while. Make sure you've got NPIV enabled on your fiber channel switches. And, of course, all of this is on the server catalog. SMIS, really important. SMIS is storage industry standard storage management. From VMM now, we can now manage SMIS. So we can manage your different SAN appliances from different partners. We can now manage the Windows Server file server. We can also manage the new iSCSI target in Server 2012 R2, which speaks SMIS as well. So we're making huge investments in SMIS going forward. And from a networking standpoint, here are the features you want to look for. VMQ. Make sure your NICs have VMQ. We like VMQ a lot. And the new virtual RSS that we're delivering requires VMQ to get you that virtual RSS in the VM. NVGRE, our network virtualization is using an industry standard protocol. That's what NVGRE is. And most importantly, it gives you that flexibility between the clouds. Because if you want to take your workloads that you've created in your own private cloud and move it up to a public cloud or to a service provider, guess what? NVGRE is the way it's going to work. That network virtualization allows you to take your network to the cloud. Open Management Infrastructure, OMI. This is still very early on, but in fact, Arista, for example, has already released a top-of-rack switch with OMI. The reason why this is important is because VMM can now manage your top-of-rack switches. So with System Center, I can manage my compute, my storage, my virtual networks, my logical networks, and my top-of-rack switches without ever leaving my console. And you can bet there are more network switch vendors on the way to add support for it. Also look for plugins for System Center. Like you saw the Symantec plugin today, we're seeing a lot more people plugging into it. We're very excited because it's really great to be able to do that all without leaving the context of System Center. And again, we have a rich, rich ecosystem. Finally, just want to close with, don't forget, the best platform for Microsoft apps. If it's Dynamics, Exchange, Link, SharePoint, SQL, we test, we run this. The best way to do it is running on Hyper-V managed by Microsoft System Center. And with that, I just want to say thank you very, very much. I hope you have a wonderful time the rest of the week here at TechEd Europe. If you have any questions for myself or Amit from Symantec about NetBackup, please come on up. We'd be happy to answer any of those questions. Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of your week at TechEd. Muchas gracias.